You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Episode number 23 of That One Time on Tour is brought to you by the band Swamp 78. Swamp 78 is an alternative rock band from Charlotte, North Carolina. Their influences range from Paramore and Shinedown to He Is Legend and Flyleaf. For more information on the band, check out facebook.com/swamp78 and on Twitter and Instagram @whoisswamp78. You can also check them out on all of the major music streaming platforms. Now here it is, their new single, Self-Portrait.
Yeah. Against, and you are listening to That One Time on Tour.
Run for the gold, cause it's going on and on. We'll be driving through the darkest night until the break of dawn. We'll be heading for the cities, another show for us to play. To get back in the van, cause tomorrow we'll do it. We'll do it all again.
Hello and welcome to episode number 23 of That One Time on Tour. As always, I'm your host, Chris Swinney, back with another stellar conversation with someone in or around the music industry. This week on the show, I get to sit down with Mr. Zach Blair from Rise Against. Zach also played in Hagfish, Only Crime, and Gwar. He was in Gwar. That's pretty awesome. So before I get to my conversation with Zach, I do need to take care of some business. You know, we do have some sponsors that help keep the lights on. You heard at the beginning of the show, Swamp 78, great band. Check them out. We also have a new sponsor, Sticker Wolf, stickerwolf.com. Go check them out there. They're out of Orlando, Florida. They did some amazing stickers for the podcast. If you guys want one, hit me up and I will hook you up. So check out stickerwolf.com. You can also check them out on Instagram and Twitter at stickerwolf. Make sure to go to MuncieMusic.com. I work at Muncie Music Center. It's an amazing store here in Muncie, Indiana. I teach guitar there and a lot of other things. They have a recording studio. They have everything. So if you're local, go to 600 South Mulberry Street here in Muncie. If not, go to MuncieMusic.com and give them some love. I have to tell you about Rockabilia.com. If you haven't, you know, heard me say this enough, they have been a sponsor for a while. Rockabilia.com is your one-stop shop for everything band merch related. They have over 500,000 unique items officially licensed by the bands. So go to Rockabilia.com and at checkout, put in the promo code PCTOTOT, and you're going to save 15% on your entire order. Okay, no more business, but I do want you guys to make sure that you are following us on all of the social media platforms. It's at TOTOT Podcast. If you want to be a sponsor, hit me up, TOTOTPodcast@gmail.com. Leave us some love or some hate on the TOTOT hotline. That is 1-765-372-8818. Make sure in the iTunes store or wherever you listen to podcasts that you review and rate us and also subscribe so you don't miss out on any future episodes. We're on Stitcher now, so if you guys are listening to us on Stitcher, what's up? And that's it. So I do want to give a shout out to my wife. She is amazing. Felicia, thank you so much for being amazing. And for some reason, she loves me, and I'm going to take it. So she helps me out quite a bit with the podcast when I'm doing my interviews and whatnot. She's got the kids. She's got little mini Swinney and mini Miss Swinney, Indian Silas, my daughter and my son. So give it up to my wife. Thank you so much for helping me out with this. I love you. I don't give her shout outs enough. I need to do that. So, okay, that's enough mushy stuff. We're going to get right into my conversation with Mr. Zach Blair from the band Rise Against. Hey, so I'm on the phone with Mr. Zach Blair from Rise Against. How are you doing today, Zach?
I am really good, man. If my voice is cutting out, there's somebody calling on the other line, but I'm going to ignore it.
Okay.
No, I'm really good, man. We are home. Rise Against has been home for 3 weeks. I leave tomorrow to resume our second leg of our tour. We have already started out the summer with we had Anti-Flag and AFI out with us, which has been a really Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, man. They're a great bunch of guys. And, you know, we've toured with Anti-Flag before, but the band's never toured with AFI before, outside of some festival dates and things like that. And they've just been really close friends for a long time. So, and so tomorrow starts the second leg, and it's been going great.
You're flying out, I take it. Where are you guys starting the second leg at?
Tomorrow is Minneapolis.
Okay.
Yeah, so we kind of resume there. It's funny because, you know, I live in Austin, Texas. I'm from Texas and I'm still here, and we are here within the first few days, so I get to come home for a few days, which is nice after we start. So yeah, all in all, pretty easy.
So I know we had to reschedule this. Could you tell me a little bit about what happened? You said there was some electrical problems at your house over Labor Day.
Yeah, it's the most banal, boring thing in the world, but some of my lights were out on the deck of my house, and it was an electrical problem that I actually kind of troubleshot myself and ended up being able to fix it. But it took, because I don't do things like that, it ended up taking a lot longer than I would have expected. So you and me were supposed to do this on, what was it, Sunday,
yeah.
And I was just like, dude, this is – and we have people coming over. So there was like – I had a deadline, and I was like, I am not going to be able to – I got to give myself the whole day.
Well, it actually worked out, because, I mean, being a holiday weekend, I had plans as well. So I was just like you. I was going to try to squeeze it in. So when you said we couldn't do it, I'm like, hey, no problem, man.
Yeah, luckily I was able to figure it out. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Okay, so I want to jump right in. The first thing that I always ask my guests – is, you know, punk rock is kind of a unique genre. I know you're pretty deep in punk rock. What was your first experience, like musical, even if it wasn't like in punk rock, and what drove you into the genre?
My first real experience with music, is that what you're saying?
And then punk rock? Music, and then like what led you to punk rock after that?
My father was a radio DJ. When a DJ actually meant a disc jockey, like a guy that talked to you on the radio and played records. That's what my dad did for a living, my whole life. He was blind, my father. He had partial sight in one eye. So a lot back then, a lot of his friends had sort of physical ailments. You know, some of them were handicapped, no use of their legs. I remember one man that was his good friend had a full face birthmark.
Wow.
And my dad was blind, and but they all had great voices, you know, so it was a kind of a thing back then with that profession. And anyway, so that's what my father did, and he had this really amazing taste in music. Amazing. To this day, it's, you know, I still – like the music my dad listened to from back then is still the music I listened to, which was – for the most part, you know, Black Sabbath and The Who and Jimi Hendrix and, you know, I guess what you would call classic rock.
Yeah.
But for my dad, you know, Led Zeppelin and all of that stuff. And so he raised my brother and I to be, you know, real big music fans. And another thing about our family is, like, we – DJs – didn't make a lot of money back then, definitely not enough to afford a family. And he just kind of still wanted to do it. So we would end up hawking our TV and stuff a lot and keeping the stereo. So we always had stereo. We always had his records. And so it just sort of fostered in this idea that, to me, that music was the most important thing.
That's great.
At an early age. And my dad was obsessed. You know, he was obsessive about it. It wasn't something he left at work. And so, you know, he'd come home and he would just talk about it all the time. And he would watch, you know, the Woodstock show, a concert, and, you know, and really raise my brother and I around it. And so I just loved my dad, and I always wanted to impress my dad. So he was also kind of a frustrated musician. He wanted to be a musician, and he never sort of had the impetus to, you know, go the full distance with it. So he was like how most dads are that way about, you know, sports with their kids. They push their kids into doing sports and stuff. My dad did it to me and my brother with music.
Wow.
Kind of just bought us instruments and sort of sat them in front of us and was just like, okay, now what, you know? and then became sort of aggro about us practicing, you know, really getting into it, kind of living vicariously through us.
Did you take like formal lessons for the guitar when you were young?
I did at one point, and I was hyperactive, and I still am. So I tried it a few different times, and, you know, I definitely picked up – it definitely advanced me more than if I had done it on my own, you know. But I would fall out with them, you know. Usually I was into stuff. I mean, even my dad's tastes were sort of more progressive than even these old men. You know, I remember wanting to learn like Led Zeppelin songs, and, you know, and stuff like that, because I was 9 when I started playing, and they were trying to show me Everly Brothers tunes and
yeah,
shit like that. Maybe the Beatles, you know, maybe whatever. And then that was my first guitar teacher. And then my second one, I had gotten into – my brother guy got into like our own music. So we went from my dad's, you know, more metal leanings like Sabbath and whatnot, ended up to my brother and I being Metallica. And then we went on that, like every kid – most kids do, you want to go harder and faster and louder and more aggressive. And so then I was coming in with like Slayer and Creator and Possessed, and they were fully not into that. But also for my brother and I, to answer the punk question, we sort of, you know, got into, say, Metallica, and then the shirts they were wearing.
Dude, that's the entrance for me as well. Like, I got my first Misfits CD because of James and Cliff wearing the shirts. I mean,
and I hope this doesn't sound like name dropping, because I'm absolutely not. I'm not pretending or nor saying
name drop away. I've met Metallica. They're great guys.
Well, yeah. So it's not, I'm not saying I know them. We've played a bunch of festivals with them.
Yeah.
And had the ability to meet, not even much, but like occasionally. And I did meet Lars Ulrich one time, and I thanked him. I was like, man, I got into Life Sentence and the Misfits and Samhain, you know, so many bands because – and he acted as if it was the first time he'd ever heard that.
It might have been. I mean, that's kind of an odd thing. Yeah.
Yeah. He goes, really? And I go, yeah. And I said, I go, is this the first time you're hearing this? He goes, yeah, man, that's amazing. And I go, well, you guys were my gateway drug to so many other – great bands. And then from those bands, you'd look at the bands they thanked on their record.
Oh, yeah.
So you buy the Misfits record, and they thanked, you know, the Necros or De Kreutzer or whatever it was. And then you just – it's this thing. And then from Metallica, you know, you get into – for me, it was like thrash metal and punk. So I got into like – my brother and I were really just trying to get into anything aggressive,
yeah,
fast, you know, something that pissed off, something that no one else was listening to. Because we lived in Sherman, Texas. It's an hour north of Dallas. And we were...
Dude, I grew up in a town in Indiana with 1,500 people, so I totally understand.
Exactly. And, you know, now you see a kid with a shirt on like that, it's totally normal. Back then, if we saw a kid with any of the bands we listened to, it was like they had landed from Mars, you know?
And it was like, because you were in a club. It's like you see those guys that drive Harleys. If they see another Harley, they kind of nod at him.
Dude. Exactly. And so, you know, I remember getting Slayer Reign of Blood the same day I got Black Flag My War.
Wow.
So it was like anything that was aggressive and loud and not the status quo and that no one else listened to, we were into. We didn't have the luxury, I've said this a lot, but the luxury of being aligned to a coast.
Yeah.
You know, we were from the fucking Midwest, Southern Midwest, you know. So...
Did you do the mail order thing a lot? That's what I did a lot when I was young.
For sure. Absolutely.
You would just like a wing and a prayer. You hope it's going to be a good album.
Dude, totally. I think I got No Means No Wrong from the Alternative Tentacles mail order because the cover looked cool, yeah, you know? And yeah. And sometimes you'd strike out like, oh Jesus, I don't like this. but that was, I still love that record to this day. So that's kind of how it all happened, just like a gateway, or like a, from my dad's taste, we sort of springboarded into our own thing that got just more gradually more and more and more aggressive and loud and fucked up. And my parents were super supportive. You know, we weren't raised in some like typical Texan, you know, Christian right-wing household. My parents were both fucking weirdos. They came from the hippie generation. They were the outcasts of their family, you know, so we were really lucky with that, because I had so many friends that were raised in just fucking uptight Southern Baptist,
oh yeah,
you know, right-winger families that didn't let them express themselves, would have disowned them if they had come out to them, if that was the case, or if they wanted to grow their hair or anything. And just, you know, it was like, you fucking live the way we want you to live, and that's the only way to live, you know. And we lucked out with that. We were broke, but
you were free to, you know, express yourself and have art and do, I mean, that, I think that's almost worth more sometimes, you know.
Absolutely. I wouldn't give up the way I was raised, you know, for to be the rich kid, you know what I mean? Totally. To have it all, you know, because there were those kids in our school. And oddly enough, you know, it's like those kids you envied and those kids that talk shit to you. And they're usually the kids that stayed in your home fucking town.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Definitely.
And I think growing up the way, you know, it sounds like you had a similar experience to me, the way you and I did only forced us to get out of that shitty little town. It was like, fuck this. I'm looking for something else. And that was probably the most formidable thing about my life was the fact that I got out of that town. I wasn't happy, you know.
I tell you, I've come pretty much full circle though. I've been all over the place and lived all over the place. But once I had kids, I actually came back to fairly close to my hometown just because I liked the hustler mentality and kind of like the way that I was raised, and I kind of wanted my kids to feel that too. I didn't want them to be so entitled because we lived at the beach before.
Oh, sure.
So, I mean, it's not like I'm taking the beach away from my kids. I just want them to be like, you know, hungry for it. And when you do have success in music or any other field, it's you don't take it for granted. You know what I mean?
Well, sorry, I'm eating something. It sounds okay. Like... it was your choice to go back, though. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it was totally my choice.
Yeah, you got out and you made the choice to go back. And also, with kids, I would imagine your folks still live there.
Yeah, my folks still live here, and it was a big deal to have family close. I wanted my kids to know my family, and I love my family. They're, you know, the way that you speak fondly of your parents is the same way I feel. I mean, they raised me to be a forward thinker, and they raised me with art and everything, so I totally relate to what you're saying.
Well, in the grand trajectory of it all, I managed to move 4.5 hours away from my hometown. I live in Austin, Texas. I grew up in Sherman, which is 4.5 hours away. So I didn't get far. You know what I mean?
But Austin's kind of like this little oasis in Texas. I mean, I love Austin.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm so sorry.
Dude, enjoy your food. This is just a conversation, I mean, man. It's not a regular interview.
I did 14 years in Dallas.
Okay.
So I went from Sherman to Dallas and did 14 years there. Then moved here. And I've been here about 14 years, which is crazy. That means I would have been, yeah, that's not right. But anyway.
a long time in both places. We'll just say that.
Exactly. I still haven't moved that far away from my hometown.
Yeah.
You know, I could still get to my mom and all that. But, you know, if I had had kids, which I did not. And I have not. I probably would have felt the same need. I'm married. My mother-in-law lives around the corner from us, so there's that. But I definitely get the need to move back and be around family when that sort of situation happens. You know, of course, absolutely.
I just feel like, I mean, I've been a lot of different places in Indiana. To me, there you never have to look for parking. It's fairly safe, and anywhere that I want to go, I just hop on a plane or I can drive anywhere within a day. You know.
That's funny you bring up parking. You're right, man. That is the bane of the existence. It's like, I can't fucking park anywhere. What was your tenure in the Ataris?
I was only in the Ataris for a couple years, probably the mid-2000s to late-2000s. I was in there after the big record hit. And I played in a band called Brazil that was on Fearless Records. And I also played with a band called Underminded that was on Kung Fu. So I've done a lot of touring. The Ataris was kind of the biggest thing that I'd ever done, but
sure. Sure. I've known. Yeah. I mean, it feels like I've been playing around or with or somewhere around the Ataris, whether it was Hackfish or Only Crime or whatever it was I was doing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's been a name that, that's had legs for sure. That band's been around.
They've been around for a long time. And that's the thing. Chris with a K, I'm Chris with a C. The singer, Chris, good buddy of mine, old bandmate. He grew up in the next town over from me. So he's got the same kind of story, man. We've talked about, even on the podcast, how he got into punk and how he got into everything. So I think it's a pretty common thread.
Yeah. I've met Chris. God, I don't even know when I met Chris. It was in the 90s at some point, but yeah. Those dudes, you know, it's the lifers.
Yeah, the lifers. It's like you can.
Well, yeah, and I don't even think, you know, for me, there wasn't another choice.
Yeah.
There wasn't, I guess, you know, I could call it a lifer now, but I think when I first started, I was just too dumb to think of anything else. And I don't mean that to sound shitty. It's just, I was just ignorant. I just left myself one thing because I figured that was like what people did.
Yeah.
To me, because I never had a fucking dime to my name growing up, that it didn't matter. I didn't care about, I would make it work. You know, I lived in a garage with eight people. I slept on floors my whole, you know, I went without food. It didn't, I just wanted to be happy. And so my only option was just play guitar. That's all I wanted to do.
I mean, that's kind
and
of,
I knew people that I went to, well, go ahead.
No, that's the same thing with me. I mean, like I make my living in music and I have ever since I got out of high school. I was a professional touring musician, different bands, whatnot, but I also teach guitar. I owned a recording studio for a while. I was an entertainment director. I lived in Jamaica for Margaritaville. I booked all their acts and did all that stuff. I worked for the Hangout Music Festival. Like, I've never done anything that wasn't music related. I even have a music summer camp for kids here in Muncie, Indiana. Like, it's all music, all music all the time. I just, once I had my kids, I didn't feel like the road was where I wanted to be. You know what I mean?
Sure. Well, that's understandable. You know, my guys in Rise, I'm the only one in Rise Against that doesn't have kids. And I see, you know, it's hard. I see how hard it is on them. And I see, you know, how the optimal thing is to be at home with the kids. You know what I mean? For sure. But yeah, I just, you know, I grew up around people that, you know, from an early age, everyone knew kind of what they wanted to do. Like, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be a doctor. And I just wanted to play guitar, probably because of my dad. And that's all I set my sights on. And there was definitely rough times, you know what I mean? Where you're like, you know, you're getting into your 30s and you're just like, maybe I should figure something out. You know, stay the course because you don't really have anything else to do or that you're good at for sure, you know.
So you played, you had Hagfish and Only Crime. Was your brother in both of those bands with you as well?
My brother was.
Okay. Your brother's name's Donnie, correct?
Donnie, yeah. And so the idea when we were kids was to play together forever. And that's a romantic thought, and it's amazing. And I wish, to this day, I wish that was still the case. We're brothers. You know, we have a vernacular, this unspoken thing. And we're only 19 months apart, so we're just really, really close. We're not like other siblings where they just do that thing where they don't get along. And we started Hagfish together, and Hagfish had a level of success and started doing pretty well, and out of high school and touring the world and got, this was in the early 90s or mid 90s. So everyone wanted a Green Day. Every major label wanted a Green Day. So the major labels were descending on small towns and bigger, you know, they wanted that. And they just, there was London Records thought Hagfish would be their version of Green Day. Cause you know, we, it wasn't off, really off mark. We were trying to be the Descendants, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we had, no one knew who the fuck we were. We had one guy in Los Angeles had gotten, we had put a record out in Dallas, like a local label had put our record out. And somehow it made it to this one guy out in Dallas who was a manager. And he decided to start shopping it around for us. He asked us if it was okay. And he did. And, you know, we really wanted to just do like Fat Wreck or Epitaph or whoever else. But we also had no connections. We didn't know anyone. And we had been touring pretty solidly through the Midwest for a couple years. So we were a touring act. We just weren't going to the coasts, you know? And, so anyway, he got London Records involved and they signed our band, which was crazy. And at the time, Bill and Stefan had just opened the Blasting Room. So we were maybe I used to say we were the first record there. I think we were the second official record to record with them because we had been opening for them ever since we had met them when we were children. I mean, I met him when I was 16. This is now I'm like 20, you know.
I wanted to get into that because, as you know, your good friend Stefan Edgerton was on the show last week. And I know you guys are tight. So I'd like to hear about that relationship with the Descendants a little bit.
Well, you know, it started from us completely punishing them and fanboying and, you know, hey, Billy, you want a bonus copy? You know, I mean, seriously, all the like annoying things. I was 16, you know, and I'm meeting my heroes.
Yeah.
Like every kid at that age, their music speaks to that kid that is disenfranchised, that feels like he's the only one there. No girls like him. He's a fucking weirdo. You know, and my brother and I were obsessed with fart humor and, you know, boner comedies and all that shit.
Yeah.
And we, you know, it just spoke to us the way somebody would explain the way Bob Dylan speaks to them. The Descendants spoke to us. And so much so that we decided to just, like, let's just completely rip them off and make a band. I don't know if Hackers sounded like them to everybody else, but to us, we're like, let's do the Descendants thing here. And we met them. We thought we got on their nerves. They ended up staying with our drummer. We had a drummer at the time in Dallas. They ended up staying there because they had a school bus at the time. It had totally broken down. And our drummer was this kid that was just a genius. And he helped them fix their truck. So they remembered that about us. So the next time they were like, hey, you guys want to open for us when we come back through? And we were, I mean, dude, this might have been us, you know, opening for Van Halen at like Madison Square Garden. We were so, oh my God. And that's kind of how we formed the friendship. I was 16, 17 years old. And so then we just started, we kept at it. We kept getting better. We kept writing better songs. We got a drummer involved, a guy named Tony Barsotti. We went through a bunch of lineups and they loved this kid to this day. Just, he was their favorite drummer. And I really think that helped us a lot with them. So we ended up getting signed to London Records, you know, because we got signed up in the Green Day swoop. You know, everybody wanted the fucking Green Day. I think it was like, you know, Goldfinger got signed and everybody, you know, all those bands got signed to major labels at that point.
It's funny that you're saying that because I had Charlie from Goldfinger on a couple weeks back and we were having the same conversation, like that post Nirvana, like right when Green Day hit and everybody was going crazy.
Exactly. And so, and I think they thought we might have been like a ska kind of thing too, because we wore suits for whatever reason.
Okay.
But there was no element of that in our band at all. And so our first thing to do with the major label money was like, well, let's go record with Bill and Steph. And they just opened this studio. I don't think the label wanted us to do that because they didn't really know nor care who the Descendants are all, but all had actually signed to a major label as well. They signed to Interscope. And they, with their money, they had opened their studio. So we recorded there, and that just started – we were already tight with them, but that just started this, like, real-deal family relationship that continues absolutely to this day. It's almost like my career has completely satellited around them. I did Guar, which had nothing to do with them, but everything else. So it's like Hagfish, Only Crime, and then Rise – I joined Rise Against and met those guys and all that. I know we're jumping ahead here because Only Crime had toured with Rise Against and Bill was recording Rise Against records. So it was just this seamless, we've been watching that guy play. We like the way he plays. Bill vouches for him. And it just, there was no audition. It was just like, you're in our band now. You know what I mean?
So you didn't know Tim and Joe and all those guys?
I knew them. Because Hagfish's second record, going back, the major label record, we did one record, a record called Rock Chalet Mass with Bill and Stefan. It did nothing. It didn't sell anything. We toured our asses off with everyone from Bad Brains, NOFX. We toured with everybody. And then went out and got the recognition from all the labels and people that we were trying to get from the first place, you know. So Fat Mike ended up putting out our second record. We also did that with Bill and Stefan. And there was a band on that. It was Honest Dons. Remember when Fat Records did
Honest Dons? I remember that, yeah.
So they had signed us, and they signed a band called the Teen Idols.
Oh, I remember the Teen Idols from Nashville.
Yeah. Yes. And Teen Idols guitar player's name was Phil.
And Philip filled in for Rise Against for a while. I remember that.
Exactly. And so they came through Dallas, and because we were label mates and they were our boys, we'd already done some things with them, Hackfish had. Phil just called me. He wasn't text me. You couldn't text back then. He called me and was like, hey, I'm filling in for that band Rise Against. They're that new band on Fat. I mean, they were brand new on Fat. And at that point, they used to send you all the records when they would put them out. And I really liked it. I thought, wow, this sounds really different for Fat Rat.
You're talking about The Unraveling, that first one with Dan?
The Unraveling.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
They came through. They played Dallas. I went out to hang out and talk to Phil. And I met those guys then. So I met them on The Unraveling. But, and just acquaintance. Like, hey, dude, what's going on? Well, then cut to like 2005, and they were already starting to do pretty well. Like they were touring the Siren Song and the Counterculture record.
Yeah.
And that had Swing Life Away. They were doing well. And that's where we really, we toured, the only Crime tour with them. And Bill had produced Revolutions Per Minute at that point. So it was all in the family at that point. And I got to be really close with them on that tour.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. And so after that tour, things weren't working out with their guitar player. And so they decided, and I was the first, there was just like, seriously, hey, would you want to be in our band? And at the time, I was in Only Crime. Only Crime had just recorded our second record, and we're leaving to start touring that record.
Was Only Crime like a very active band, though? Because wasn't Russ from Good Riddance the singer?
Yeah, and Aaron from Bane was the guitar player. It wasn't very active. It was, for not very active, we still kind of toured a lot. Like, yeah. You know, we went to Europe a few times, went to Japan. We did a few states things. It was at the time Bill was really busy with the studio. So it was really whenever he could get away. And for him, it was really to get away from the studio. He was sick of telling punk bands how to play their instruments. You know what I mean? Like his ears were getting burned out, and he wanted to play drums again.
Yeah.
And he wanted to just play drums. He didn't want to be the guy that called all the shots and wrote all the songs. He just wanted to like play aggressive drums. And it was awesome. It was fucking awesome. Bill's still one of my best, not only is he my mentor, like my big brother, he's still one of my best friends.
Well, and he's one of the most, I think, underrated drummers in the world. I think he's one of the best drummers. He doesn't get the accolades that some other drummers get, and I think he deserves it.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And so we just had great fucking time. We've developed a vernacular of inside jokes and potty humor and just, you know, shit over the fucking years. And so it was just so much fun. And I got to play with my brother. So that was in like 2005, Rise, Only Come Tour with Rise. And I joined, it was 2 years later. I joined pretty much in January of 2007.
What were you doing at the time? Were you playing in bands or were you working a job?
I was just doing Only Crime and working whatever day job I could when I was home. I had moved to Austin by that point, and there weren't a lot of jobs to be had in Austin. I was printing T-shirts. I was doing some construction. Only Crime was touring like a part-time band. So I had a tour to look forward to within every few months.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But everyone, I was definitely putting out like, you know, looking into my options because Bill understood, you know, Aaron would come back home with Only Crime and then go right out with Bane, or Bill would, or Russ would do something with Good Riddance. And I was just coming home and trying to find some fucking way to make money.
Yeah.
And so when Rise happened, it was kind of like, this is what you're doing. This is it. And Bill really did understand. And Bill was excited because, you know, we've developed a working relationship beyond a friendship that works really, really well. And I mean, God, that guy's more or less trained me, you know, since I was a kid to what to do and what not to do with every aspect of my career, you know, from the business end of it to actually how to play and do things the right way. And Bill's a ridiculously good guitar player as well. And, you know, yeah, so it just kind of worked out on all levels, and it was a really serendipitous, awesome thing, you know.
So your first record that you appeared on with Rise Against was Appeal to Reason in 2008, which actually like peaked at number 3 on Billboard. What's that feeling got to be like where you go from playing once in a while in Only Crime, maybe having some, you know, some success on a certain scale, but then being in a band whose record actually is number 3 on Billboard? That's got to be kind of a crazy extreme.
Yeah, it was a lot, you know. And, you know, for me, my career up until then had been these just mountaintops and valleys, you know. Like, Hackfish was successful and toured with a lot of bands, and then nothing. And then Gwar was Gwar.
Yeah.
And, you know, already successful when I got in the band and touring in a bus and flying and doing all this shit. And then I quit that. I chose to quit that because of extenuating circumstances. And then nothing. And then Only Crime. And it just all these things. And then that was this huge peak. You know, I'd never anything of that sort of commercial success I'd never been a part of.
Yeah.
And so it was really a lot to take in. And, you know, you got to think, like I said, I joined in January 2007. halfway through touring for Suffer and the Witness. This was the next year,
yeah.
You know? So, the band was already doing really well. You just had to take it in stride, you know what I mean? And keep your head down and kind of do the job at hand, which was get back in that bus, show up at the next gig and play as well as you can. And just, you know, rinse and repeat, which has felt like that for the last almost 12 years now, you know?
Yeah, that's crazy. I actually, I know the guys okay. I haven't seen him in a long time. I used to, my first band I ever had was this little punk band called Chronic Chaos. And I was friends with Dan, the old guitarist, the original guitarist.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he produced my band's first two full lengths at his studio in Chicago. And on their first ever shows, like after they signed to Fat, they came and opened up for my band at this theater in Indiana. It was amazing. I was like,
oh, that's awesome.
I was like, you guys, we played on a wrestling ring. I've talked to Tim about it. Tim talked in like Rolling Stone about his worst show ever was on a wrestling ring. And I'm like, dude, that was the show that I booked for you guys.
I think I've actually heard a story about that. He's told me about that too, like the wrestling ring show.
Well, I mean, imagine trying to play a show on a trampoline. That's pretty much what it
exactly,
is.
Exactly. It's got to be the worst. But yeah, man, it's just been that little engine that could, you know, it's kind of, and you know, I mean, rock music, anything with a guitar right now, it's definitely taking sort of a sidestep.
Yeah.
Shall we say? that feels pretty permanent, you know, and not that I'm complaining. I think anything definitely has its time, and then it kind of goes the way of the buffalo. Not the way of the buffalo, but I think it's hard out there for bands with guitars. You know, it is.
Yeah,
we're still doing well. Don't get me wrong, but.
Well, I've noticed that you guys tend to, some of the bigger festivals that I've seen that you guys have played, like in Europe, a lot of the lineups seem to be a lot of metal bands. Do you guys fit in well with those bands?
I don't know if it's well, but you know, as well I do, like Europe has this very broad taste. It's not like in Europe, you, at least with the fans, for me, the same people that go to see dance shows and raves, they go into metal shows and they're going to punk shows. It's not like I'm into metal and that's it. So
does seem a little bit more open in Europe. Like the times that I've been over there, it's, you would play a show with maybe a band that you wouldn't play with in the States, you know?
Sure. Well, and you also see this convergence of, because it's almost like bands with guitars are just playing together nowadays, whether it's a band like us with a metal band or whatever. It's just, there's so, it's the nature of the things is kind of killing bands off, because it's really hard for a band to get it started. You know, bands now are asking me, how did they get going? I'm like, well, look, the way I did it was put my shit in storage, what little shit I had, and got in a van and left and didn't come home until you started seeing people show up at shows. I don't know if that's the way it works anymore.
Well, I've told people that too. Like, I have these students that I have at my rock and roll summer camp, which actually they're doing two Rise Against songs. So maybe I'll get you to do a shout out or something later for the kids. But I tell them all the time, they're like, you know, how did you get going when you were young? I said, well, before I started touring, when I was really young, we booked our own shows at like halls and like community buildings. And then when I was on the road, we slept in the van and we ate ramen noodles. Yeah. And I mean, you sleep on floors. Like, I don't think that exists anymore.
I don't know if that's the way you do it. I know it's the way I did it, but I don't, you know, nowadays I see that we're playing festivals, and I sound like such an old fart talking about this, but like, you know, you see, because of like, say, 21 Pilots or whatever, you're seeing bands that are two guys up there. You know, one guy is playing some inorganic instrument that's programmed, and another guy might have a bass, and more power to him. I think, look, that's what punk rock did. It smashed the current system. And, you know, things need to reinvent themselves right on. I mean, things need to change. You know, I heard a thing somebody saying the other day that, like, the Spotify and the Bandcamp rappers and stuff, like, that's the new punk rock. And I agree with that statement.
Definitely, you know? Yeah.
They're doing things out of their fucking room on GarageBand, and they're putting it up with no label involvement. And they're making a career out of that. And I think that's fucking amazing.
I mean, look at Chance the Rapper. He won Grammys and like sold millions and millions. And he wasn't even signed. I mean, that's insane.
Exactly. He cut out the fucking greedy corporate bullshit of the, you know, and this is coming from a guy that's on a major label. He cut out the middleman in the most effective way that I think anyone's ever done it, because all of the good DIY punk bands did that, of course, but this guy actually won Grammys and did it, you know. So it's a real interesting way to do things. And so I'm all fucking all for it. I just also happen to be a guy that makes a career playing music and always has. And it's just, it keeps guys like me on our toes, and it should. It absolutely should. You just got to kind of think of a new way to do things. You know, before, and I've said this a bunch, I feel like records, you tour to sell the record, and now I believe the record is the flyer for your tour.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know if you guys might be doing this. I'm not sure, but a lot of bands nowadays are doing all the VIP packages, and you pay more money and you can do a meet and greet.
We don't do those.
I know you've got to make money, you've got to survive, and I hope I'm not like offending anybody listening, but I almost feel like you're kind of whoring yourself out a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not going to fucking be a part of that shit. I mean, look, if you do that, that's, like you said, the more power to you. There is, money is different nowadays out there. It is. Records are not a thing that's being sold anymore. This is, you know, the labels aren't suffering.
Yeah.
You know, labels are still making money. Bands are making even less than they were before. The royalties and the payouts from Spotify and things like that are a pittance. It's just, you know, I'm not going to complain about it because that's just the way things are. It's just the way things have always been. It's always fucking changing.
Nothing's going to change. The people that are in power are going to stay in power. And
it's up to guys like me just to keep plugging away and figuring out how to do it. But that's a thing I don't think we would ever do. We do meet and greets where come fucking up, take a picture with us. If you want a picture with our ugly faces, then fucking more power to you. Like, go for it, you know. But I ain't gonna charge you for that shit because it's not worth anything.
Give it up to like the bands that are still trying to have the careers and they're pushing the boundaries and they're doing anything they can to keep the ship upright. I mean, I don't want anybody to think that I'm being mean or anything.
Neither. It's just not our thing. But however you make a living is however you make a living, and it is rough out there. And if this is, you know, this whole thing has caused people that were in retirement to come out of retirement to have to go back on tour because they were making money off of their catalog.
Yeah.
It's just like any job. You work 25, 30 years, you retire, you built up money that's going to pay you for the rest of your life because, you know, you saved money out of your check. And people, that's really how it's worked so far. They've put out records that have gone out into the world and sold, you know, and you're making those royalties for the rest of your life. And at one point you go, I'm going to be fine, I'm going to retire. Well, records don't sell anymore. So there's nothing out there making the money. So they go, well, fuck, I need to go back on tour again. And that's been happening at an alarming rate. A lot of bands have been doing those, like reunion tours, which is fine. I mean, you just, shit, this is what you want to do. This is how it is. You know, this is how you make money now.
I would like to ask you the one thing that is selling, and it blows my mind every time I see it in the charts. On average, every week, the Black Album sells 5,000 copies. Who is buying the Black Album in 2018?
It's the starter kit, though, man.
Yeah.
Like there are those bands. If every teenage generation, you know, it's pretty fucking amazing. If you get into metal, and it used to be it was Master of Puppets, and then it was Justice for All.
Yeah.
And then it's the Black Album. The Black Album is just stuck. Nobody's going to buy Saint Anger. You know what I mean?
Yeah, nobody.
But you know, it's the starter kit. It's every 14-year-old boy going, I want to listen to metal.
Yeah.
Okay, Metallica's the band you start with. I'm going to buy the Black Album. I mean, fuck. You know, it's like the Eagles' greatest hits for our generation, or the not our generation, you know what I mean? But
yeah,
for like this generation. Because in our generation, if you wanted to get into like classic rock, you bought the Eagles' greatest hits. That's why it's the greatest selling record of all time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it is. It beat out fucking Thriller recently. You just, it's the starter kit. And it's look, we just, you and me just talked about how we got into Metallica and that got us into our whole thing. It's still happening. It's still the start. It's still the starter kit, which I think is fucking unbelievable.
Well, I want to give a shout out to one of my students. His name's Dawson. He's a big pop punk fan. And he was telling me how much he loved Blink 182. And I said, well, have you ever heard of the Descendants? And he's like, no. And he went and saw them. I think he went and saw them. If he didn't go and see them, he actually likes them now, though. He checked all their stuff out. And one of his bands at my rock and roll summer camp is doing Hope. They're doing the Hope by the Descendants. Rad. So it's cool to see. I don't know. I also think of myself as kind of a mentor because these kids will come in to me and they'll be like, oh, I love Five Finger Death Punch. And I'm like, well, let me show you some bands you'll probably like that are way better.
Right. Like what that band probably listens to, you know, and. Yeah, I think that's just awesome. There's a school of rock here that some of my a lot of people in Austin work at, which is it's just such a great program. And I've done a few things for them and, you know, like clinics and things like that and played with the kids. And I think I'm doing something in January with them. I just think all of that is so amazing, especially when, you know, a kid has a choice right now. You go to Guitar Center or wherever, you can either buy a guitar, which is going to take some real practice and some real patience and some real dedication. And in this day and age, again, I sound like an old fart, with everything taking your attention, everything is flashing at you saying, please fucking pay attention to me. And instantly gratifying, you know, a video game, VR, anything. Instantly grab. You know how to do it immediately. And you have this machine at the same place that you can start making songs tonight. You don't even have to read the fucking owner's manual. You plug it in, you press power, you can pretty much figure it out. And you can write a song tonight and record it on GarageBand. Or you can buy a guitar and in 3 months, you know.
You can maybe play something.
Right. Unless you're a complete natural, maybe you can do something. I get it. I was that kid. I was that OCD, ADD, you know, fucking hypermanic kid. And it was impossible sometimes. I wanted to give up so many fucking times. It's still hard. You know, it's still I'm still learning every day. And, you know, I get that choice a kid has to make. So these programs like yours and School of Rock, I think that's make the nobility of it is even greater because we're actually getting kids and having and doing numbers and having kids come and take the time to learn how to do this thing. You know,
I just always feel like when I was young, I was a pretty good go-getter. I had a lot of passion for music, and if I couldn't do it, I would just figure it out. And I think the internet and everything makes things so right at your fingertips that a lot of that's kind of gone. So these kids, I try to, you know, hey, you can do your own shows. You can do this. You can do that. I try to show them how to produce a show. We teach how to run the board. We teach everything. So
yeah. Well, and then there's the other thing of like, I mean, shit, there's also the kid that goes, well, wait a minute. This dude has a career and he plays that weird pad thing.
Yeah.
He writes all of his songs with that pad thing that I can buy for $200. All of his, and he's huge. His career is fucking, I'm going to do that. I'm like, dude, I get it, kid. You know, like more power to you. Fuck it. You know, I don't want to learn all this other shit. I just want to do that. I'm like, fucking go ahead. You know, more power to him. But anyway, it just makes, you know, your work and everybody, I just, you know, it's that much greater. I mean, there needs to be both. I guess. You know what I mean? I definitely identify with the one kid a little bit more, you know, because shit. But given the options now, I don't know what I would have done. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, when I was young, it was just you get a guitar because you like Metallica or you like NoFX or whatever, you know?
And that was it. That was it. You fucking do that, you know? So, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll get back on track a little bit here. I did want to ask you how it was. You did some big festivals, and you also were the supporting act for the Foo Fighters back in 2011. How did that go?
We toured with them in the States, and we did Australia with them. So 2011 was the States, yeah, and then we went to Australia with them just a few years ago, actually. It's amazing. It's amazing because, you know, this is the world's largest rock and roll band, I would say, right now.
And some of the best guys in the world, too.
Some of the best guys in the world. And seeing how that ship works and is ran, because it's still very much ran like the way we all do things.
Yeah.
You know, the vernacular, the language. And one thing that's pretty remarkable about that band is they set up a practice room every day, like Metallica do, and they practice all day. Just because they love doing it. I mean, they play, they have a list of classic rock cover songs that they go through from Rod Stewart to Led Zeppelin to The Who, and they just play all day. All day.
That's awesome.
Up until their road manager has to come in every day and go, guys, we have to go on stage.
Wow.
And so they're great every night because they're fucking warmed up. But I've known Chris Shiflett, their guitar player, since No Use for a Name days.
Oh, yeah.
So he used to be, for anybody who doesn't know, he used to be in No Use for a Name, that were on Fat Rack. And Hagfish met them forever ago. I met him at the bottom of the hill in San Francisco. And, you know, we were both kids. So I was so happy for him when he got the gig. It was fucking unbelievable, you know, that one of us was getting to go do this. And then, you know, once we toured with them, I'd never met Dave Grohl. But once we did, it melts away really quick that it's fucking Dave Grohl. This guy was in our generation's Beatles.
Yeah, yeah.
And he is the nicest, most down-to-earth, humble, amazing dude. He's just the guy you want to be around and hang out with. You know what I mean?
I met him one time, actually, in Austin, and he couldn't have been a better guy. Like, I was so freaked out because it's Dave Grohl, and you're right. Like, 5 minutes after meeting him, it's just you're talking to a guy about punk rock.
Which is exactly what I did. He found out I was in Gwar and flipped out and
awesome.
You know, wanted to just talk to me about that and what that was like, because he knew those guys because he's from Virginia as well.
Yeah.
And so he knew those guys from back in the day, and he knew when he was at Scream. And he just wants to geek out and talk about music. You know, and same with me. He loves classic rock and he loves punk rock and he loves metal. So we have, every time him and I are around, we just talk. And then one day we were in Australia with him. Joe, our bass player, was like, "You need to come play a Scream song with us." And he was like,
"That's
immediately,
awesome."
Immediately, he was like, "Sure. Guitar, drums." And we're like, "Drums." And he goes, "Cool." And Joe goes, "Came without warning," which is a Scream song. He goes, "Great, let's go practice." And we went into his room and practiced Minor Threat, Bad Brains, and Scream songs all day with him on drums. And he came out with us that night and played fucking Scream's Came Without Warning with us. It was amazing. Yeah, it was amazing. It's on YouTube.
As soon as I get off the phone, I'm going to go check that out.
Oh, and he just kills it. He just kills it. It's just him playing super fast punk rock drums. It's just amazing.
Well, and he's another guy that gives props to Bill, because it's like Bill's like his favorite drummer.
For sure. He for sure does. And still promotes. You know, I saw that. I just recently saw that play thing he did, which is, if you watch it, it's a video. It's a 23-minute long song.
Oh, it's awesome. It's great.
It's amazing. And he's promoting a school like what you do in School of Rock, what we were talking about, where kids go after school and they, you know, play guitar and they play drums, they play rock and roll music. He uses his powers for good, not evil.
Yeah.
You know, simply put. And he has a lot of power. And I just, you know, a better role model and a better figure in this crazy business, I don't think there's a rival. What a fucking nice guy, man. And he's really helped. Shit, he took our band on tour twice, you know, which is amazing.
How was the reception? I mean, you guys have quite a name anyway. You could probably sell out a lot of those places anyway, but how was the reception from their fans for you guys?
We do okay, but not Foo Fighters okay. You know, we realized quick, we still had a lot of work to do when we went out there, and you're opening for the Foo Fighters. They don't give a shit. And you'll play, you know, for us, it's like we have a popular song called Savior. It's like the song people know of ours. We'll play that and you'll see some head bobbing, singing along. Like, they know that one. They don't know anything else.
Yeah.
Nor did they give a shit. And so we were like, whoa, we still have a lot of work to do. You know, and that was great. You know, just, you know, we're a band that tries to stay pretty humble, but we realize, like, wow, we really need to stay humble. we still have a whole lot to do. So,
well, it's good to hear that a band of Rise Against size, you guys are humble and you guys realize that there's still work that needs to be done. So I think that's a breath of fresh air, man.
Oh my God. Yes. And I mean, I don't know if the sort of infrastructure is set up to where a band can get a rock and roll band such as ourselves could get as big as Foo Fighters at this point. We'll see trends. You never know what's going to happen, and everything is cyclical, but it's definitely an aspiration and it's something to keep trying for, you know, for sure.
That's awesome. So you guys, in 2010, you covered Sliver by Nirvana. Did you tell Dave that, or had he heard that or anything?
No, I don't think it ever came up. I mean, honestly, man, you know, we might have at some point. I don't – tend to, when I have been around him, I don't ever want to bring that up because I never know. Do you know what I'm saying?
I totally get it. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. At one point, we were out with them, and it happened to be the 20th anniversary, maybe the 25th anniversary of Nevermind. I think it was the 20th anniversary. And he had Chris Novoselic out on tour to come up and play a few songs with him. And so we're sitting at catering that day, and Chris Novoselic wanders over, and he sits at our table, and he's just minding his own business and eating. And we're like, this is cool. And then Pat Smear comes over. And then
you guys are eating with the surviving members of Nirvana.
No, dude, Pat and then Dave.
That's amazing.
And they started talking about old times and stuff, and it was really amazing. It's one of those things that happens on tour where you're like, wow, we are really lucky.
This definitely. Yeah, yeah.
And it really was cool. But I never know where – and he's such a nice, great guy, and I know he's such a nice, great guy. He'd probably take it totally in stride, and it wouldn't be weird at all. But I also, because he's so nice, I wouldn't want to put it upon him to go, hey, let's talk about Nirvana, you know, and let's talk about this – possibly touchy situation that, you know, there's emotions hanging off of. I would want to put him in that position. I tend to be a person that's very bad with my boundaries when it comes to somebody that has questions and wants to ask, and I'll talk about things that I'm uncomfortable about. Present party excluded, trust me. But where, hey, this is just a human being. They want to know this thing, and who am I?
Yeah.
And then I'll kind of open up this sort of Pandora's box of emotions, and then I'm talking about things. I'm like, oh, God, you know. Because I'm that way, it's pretty much I'm projecting on somebody else, and I wouldn't want to do it, but that's just me.
Cool. So one thing I did want to ask you about, Wolves, that came out last year, your new record. How was the recording process? You guys went back to the blasting room with Bill and Jason, right?
No, we did Wolves with a guy named Nick Raskulinics.
Oh, okay.
Who in Nashville. And Nick had worked with Foo Fighters, actually. He had worked on a couple of the records. I believe he worked on One by One. I believe he worked on In Your Honor. I could be getting those wrong. But he's worked on some Deftones records. He's worked on some Rush records. He's he's like one of the remaining sort of real rock and roll producers. And it was at the time, Bill, you know, the Descendants were going back full force. They were very busy. And for us, it kind of felt like, oh, we've made four records in a row.
Try something new, right?
Yeah. Well, the band had made four records in a row with Bill. I had made three, Appeal to Reason, Endgame, Black Market. And it was time to try something else out, but also the scheduling just didn't work. And it was great. It was a great experience. I think we made a great record out of it. But I do think, you know, here recently this year, we went back to Bill and did this new acoustic record that's out.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking of. I think the Ghost Note Symphonies, right? Or Ghost Note Symphonies. Yeah,
we did go back and that was just, man, it's just going home.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
It's felt like, for me now, a 23-year working relationship, but shit, I mean, 27-year friendship.
Wow.
So it's just going back to this, like, it feels like one continuous record. All the way back to Hagfish's first album, I just feel like I'm going in and I'm just adding to the same record. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I do, you know, I would intimate at this point that we will be going back for our next record, which is as of yet unplanned, unwritten. We're just trying to get through this tour first, you know.
Can you tell me a little bit about Ghost Note Symphonies? I know it's like you guys kind of reimagined some older songs and you did some different instrumentation and whatnot. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, it started as just an idea, just like, let's go record a few songs acoustically to sort of amend the Wolves album, because, you know, they do repressings of records and stuff. So we thought it'd be kind of interesting to do some older songs, maybe some songs that are on Wolves, do them acoustically. And then once we got in there, it was so fun to kind of reimagine things with different instrumentation, different versions, that we decided to, like, well, let's keep going. And we ended up with 10. And so then it was just about kind of trying to talk the label into, hey, can we put out a full length with this? And they were into it. And so, it seems to be doing, it's fun. And hopefully, you know, at some point we can maybe do some shows around it.
That's cool, man. I have kind of a weird question. This is something I've always kind of wondered about the band. With the amount of popularity that the band has gained, and you guys are definitely
you're hard edge. You still got that punk edge, but I mean, there's kids that I know that listen to Godsmack that love you guys. So I mean, like, is it weird for you to go to these shows and maybe you're used to, like, back in the day there would just be all the punk kids there, but now it's kind of like a broader range of people? I mean, is it kind of different because you where the band came from?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're all of the age to where, yeah, you sort of aligned yourself to your thing back then. You know, you had your, you know, you even had your genres of punk. There were, like, kids that were into ska punk. And, you know, we were into, like, the SST and Cruise Records thing only, you know.
Yeah.
And again, I just think it's more characteristic of where the music is right now as a culture, to where you just are into what you're into. And because of the internet and everything be so readily available, it's almost like I'm into loud things. You know, if it's got a guitar and it's loud, I'm into it. So I think it's a great thing. I do think it's an amazing thing. And for some reason, our band has managed to be able to get on shows with more metal bands than not, you know, or take metal bands on tour with us, or pop bands, or whatever the case may be. We're just lucky. We somehow happened into that situation. The band started as very fast sort of hardcore punk band and has since morphed into, you know, we still have that sound about us, but there's other things. We've gotten into other things. And so that's kind of served us well with the different crowds, varied crowds in certain places that I feel real fortunate and lucky to be able to have, you know.
Has there been any, I mean, I guess at this point it doesn't really matter. I wouldn't care. You probably don't. Has there been any, like, pushback or any, like, from the older fans because of some of the, the new stuff's a little bit more, you know, like, friendlier, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but there's nothing you can say about that. It's like, look, nobody was in that room with us writing those records. That's all 100% us. And so it's just, you get four guys in a room and they've all been listening to different types of music over the last few years. Whatever comes out is whatever comes out, and you're still your band. And
I relate it back to Metallica, like I do with almost everything.
Oh, yeah.
People got so mad at all of that stuff and cutting their hair, but they put out an album every 6 years. I mean, think about the changes you go through personally in 6 years.
Quantify that, and I guarantee the band that's wondering, well, I wonder what the fans are going to like. They're going to end up,
they're not going to last at all.
Right. They're going to do a disservice to the fans first and foremost. So we've never done that. And as much as anybody, any snarky fucking fan wants to think, well, you know, it's corporate bullshit and label, you know, man, I've been in that room, you know, for this many years now. It's what us four are deciding. And so, you know, you just try to make yourself happy first, and then hopefully, because you've done that the whole time and you tend to have a career and people come out to the show, you just trust that they're going to like it as well.
Well, dude, that's a wonderful answer, and I totally agree with you.
You know what I mean?
So I won't take up a lot more of your time. One thing that I do want to ask, I know we talked a lot about the Foo Fighters and how cool that was, but do you have some, like, crazy tour story or something that you always tell? This is called That One Time on Tour, and I'd like to kind of pick your brain about maybe something that happened a long time ago, maybe nothing current, some kind of tour story that you've got.
Yeah, so I was in Gwar. Which is in and of itself a whole other thing, and I haven't really talked
about Gwar. You were Flatus Maximus, right?
I was Flatus Maximus.
Flatus, okay.
And I still contribute to Gwar. I'm still sort of an auxiliary member. You're kind of always in, and not their current record, but their last record, Battle Maximus. I wrote half of that, and I played guitar on half of that record, all the while doing Rise Against touring, because the guy that had replaced me years ago, Corey Smoot, he had passed away, and it's like getting called back to the family home, you know. Yeah. I went back and I was happy and honored and more than willing to do it. Well, at one point, Dave Brocky, our singer, who has also passed away.
I've met Dave, my old band. We actually played some Midwest dates with him back in the Dave Brocky Experience, his other band.
And that is the world loss.
Dave was a great guy.
He's a great guy.
Yeah.
And I miss him. I've been missing him. I miss him constantly, but I've been missing him a lot lately, like a whole lot. But anyway, I loved him, and he was also a character. And, you know, when I have had longer conversations with Dave Grohl, we've just talked about Dave Rocky. You know, if you knew him, he was a force. He was just always on. He was always hysterical. He was always loud. He was always a cartoon. He was just this larger than life character. And one time we were leaving to go to Europe, and Dave, I was walking in the airport and everybody was like, "Hey, did you check out what Brocky's doing?" And I was like, and I looked at him and he's wearing black leather pants, a leather jacket. He had long hair at the time, but he had cut it into like a military style, like high and tight.
Yeah.
And he had sunglasses, like wraparound sunglasses, and he had like motorcycle boots. And he looked exactly like Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Terminator, because Brocky also had that kind of build and he sort of even looked like him.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went up to him and I was like, hey, you look like a Terminator. And he was also acting. He sort of robotically moved his head and it's like, there is no Dave. Like he was impersonating the Terminator. This is only, you know. And so he's walking like a robot through the airport. And this was normal for Dave. Like he would just do crazy shit. And so he kept it up. And he did it for 6 weeks.
Like straight? He never broke character? Like,
he broke character when he was on stage as Odorous. But if he was off stage, he was back in all leather with the sunglasses, no matter where we were, and he was the Terminator.
It's like Andy Kaufman-esque a little bit.
It was fucking totally Andy Kaufman-esque, dude. And at one point, I was just like, man, Dave, I just want to talk to Dave. Like, it's been like 4 weeks. He's just like, there is no Dave. Like, still doing the thing. Like, you gotta be shitting me right now. And it's fair enough. Like at the end of the tour, he was back to his Dave Rocky, just like same guy.
That's awesome.
He was, yeah, just shit like that, dude. There's so many Dave stories. There's so fucking many. We could be here for hours for sure.
Well, I tell you what, man, I don't want to take up any more of your time. I would love at some point in the future, maybe do a part two. You can tell me some more Dave Rocky stories and some more stuff about Rise Against.
Just let me know.
But, I've had a blast talking to you, man, and I think that my listeners are going to love this. And awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And I will talk to you in the future, man. Thank you so much. Have a great tour.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me. Thanks a lot.
Yep, I'll talk to you soon, Zach. Thanks, man.
All right, buddy. All right.
And there it was, my conversation with Zach Blair from Rise Against. Thank you guys so much for checking out this week's episode. It was a lot of fun to talk to Zach, and hopefully we'll have him back for a part two in the near future. And next week, it just keeps rolling, man. We've got an awesome show next week. I got to sit down with Jason Wee Man Acuna from Jackass. Yes, that Wee Man. We talked about all kinds of crazy stuff, and he was a great, great guest. So you guys are going to enjoy that next week, probably on Wednesday. I think I'm going to start releasing these on Wednesday. Tuesday is kind of tough for me, but I have Tuesday off, so then I can do all of my editing and everything and then get it out Wednesday. So that's going to do it for this week. I'm going to leave you guys with a couple Rise Against songs. Before I talk about that, I do want you to follow us on all social media platforms. Our Instagram's kind of getting big right now, so check that out. I always put up all kinds of things if you want to ask the future guests like questions. Yeah, make sure you're following us on Instagram. If you want to be a sponsor like Swamp 78 at the beginning of this episode, hit me up, TOTOTpodcast@gmail.com. Make sure that you subscribe, rate, and review in the iTunes store or wherever you listen to podcasts. Like I said earlier, we are on Stitcher now, working on Spotify. So hope you guys are well. Thanks for letting me into your life once again this week. I had a blast with Zach. The Wee Man episode is going to be great. And coming up after that, we've got Nathan Gray from Boy Sets Fire, Jack O'Shea from Bayside. We've got all kinds of good guests coming up. So I cannot wait for you guys to hear those episodes. Keep coming back week in and week out, and I'll be here delivering the content. So thank you guys very much. We'll see you next week. I'm going to leave you with Savior, which is one of my favorite Rise Against songs. And after that, one of their new songs from Ghost Note Symphonies. It's the reimagined version of Like the Angel. So thank you guys very much. Here it is, Rise Against with Savior,
and like the angel. See you next week.
It kills me not to know this, but I've all but just forgotten what the color of her eyes were and her scars or how she got them. As the telling signs of age rain down, a single tear is dropping through the valleys of an aging face that this world has forgotten. That will put me in my place, and there is no time like a present to drink these drained seconds.
Penetrate you into the hallways, and that's when I
beating heart in a microphone. A ticking clock in an empty home still tells of these times so long ago. And even though I've come so far, I know I've got so far to go. And any day now I'll explode. And like the angel without you. So don't wait up, just leave the light on. 'Cause all the roads that I might take will all one day lead back to you. And like the angel you are, you have created a lightness in my chest. Your eyes, they penetrate.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.